headlines. U.S. media reports say the Biden administration is opposed to the removal of all sanctions against Iran, as demanded by Tehran to revive the JCPOA. U.S. police clashed with protesters in the state of Minnesota on the sixth night of unrest over the police killing of a black man. Also in the headlines, Human Rights Watch condemns the UK for its criticism of the International Criminal Court's investigation into Israeli war crimes. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. U.S. media have cited a source close to America's top nuclear negotiator, Robert Malley, in Vienna, as saying that Washington is opposed to the removal of all sanctions imposed on Iran. News magazine Foreign Policy has quoted a former senior advisor to Malley as saying that the U.S. is willing to remove sanctions that were only outlined in the Iran nuclear deal. Ali Vaez says the U.S. position is the same for those sanctions that have been relabeled by former President Donald Trump. He said, however, that the sanctions are not inconsistent with the JCPOA, and those he described as justified will remain in place. Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA are involved in talks in Vienna to revive the deal. Tehran has repeatedly said that the only way to revive the 2015 accord is the removal of all sanctions imposed, reimposed, and relabeled against the Islamic Republic. Heinz Kirchner is a political scientist at the International Institute for Peace. Joining us from Vienna, we also have Mustafa Hoshesh, who's a journalist and political commentator, who joins us. Gentlemen, welcome. If I may first start with you, Heinz Kirchner, we just ran a piece of breaking news here, pretty much saying what Iran has been stating, and it has been repeated, I'm sure, in the Vienna talks, and that is the removal of all sanctions. As a matter of fact, our breaking news right now is saying a source has relayed that only complete removal of sanctions of bans can salvage Vienna talks from collapse. Why is the U.S., how do you think the U.S. response has been, which has been but that?
We have to listen to the wording as such. So removal of all sanctions does not mean that you can have priorities. So you cannot remove all sanctions right away. And as I guess Iran has also priorities, because Iran brought to the Vienna negotiations not only a representative of the Iranian atomic agency, but also from the oil ministry and from the central bank. So we see already that for Iran, there are important sanctions to be lifted. And we have one working group in Vienna which looks at the sanctions, and I'm sure there will be a debate which sanctions will be lifted first. It can be that all sanctions will be lifted altogether at the end, but there will be a list of priorities. And the same is true for the second working group, which deals with Iran's commitments, how to reduce, how to go back to the original commitments by Iran. So Iran did not do it altogether at once. That the Americans understand as well, they can be go back to some of their commitments already, especially what Iran mentioned now, the 60% enrichment. It could be immediately returned to the 20%, for example, as a good sign. But I have to say, it's a very good sign that the talks in Vienna resumed after this incident, after the attack on Natanz, and also after the announcement of Iran to enrich uranium to 60%. That means there's a political agreement that they want to continue. And everything else would be a victory of the opposition of the JCPOA, whether it's in the U.S., whether it's Israel, whether it's also within Iran. So it would be a defeat of the negotiations, it would be a defeat of the current Iranian government, and also the defeat of the Biden government. So, and the attack on Natanz shows that there is progress in Vienna, that there is progress and that there is a possibility of success, and I see the attack on Natanz on an act of desperation. to stop diplomacy. So diplomacy at the end have to succeed in order to give the opponents of the JCPOA not a possibility to continue with violent acts, also with attacks on Iranian nuclear facilities, and also to stop the diplomacy.
Who do you think was behind the attack?
Probably, of course, it's an open secret that it might come from Israel, from Mossad, and also the Israeli papers already. They also mentioned that there's a sign of proudness that they could do it. But I do think if the negotiations put on the way to failure or would fail, then they wouldn't have done it. So it was an attack not on Iranian nuclear facility. It was an attack on diplomacy. It was an attack on the negotiations in Vienna. And we should not give them the chance to win over the negotiations, to win over diplomacy.
Okay. Well, Sabah Khoshesma, I'm going to ask you, official source to Press TV saying that dividing sanctions into removable, irremovable, negotiable ones not acceptable by Iran. Is the U.S. after dividing the sanctions, prioritizing the sanctions, dividing the sanctions in such a way that they think in their eyes that it would appease Iran and to move forward? Is that what the U.S. aim is, even though Iran has repeatedly said, no, they're not going to go for it?
Hello, Kavan. Thanks for having me. I don't know how much time we have. This needs to be explained to the public. I mean, technically, from two different aspects, it takes some time. I'll do my best to put it in a nutshell. As I've been saying repeatedly, and many of the Iranians have been saying, why should Iran be loyal to the nuclear deal? Why did it go for a nuclear deal in the first place? Well, to ease the economic sanctions, as it was already stressed in the JCPOA, paragraph 26, and many others, they stressed that. Well, did it happen? No, of course not. Obama never allowed that to happen. He was the first violator of the nuclear deal, and he just removed the sanctions all over the paper while they were intimidating banks several times more than asking them to work with Iran. Several times more, they asked them to stay away from Iran. So they never allowed Iran to enjoy the merits of the nuclear deal, actually, and feel the merits, economic merits. And before Biden came to office, Donald Trump and his national security advisor said this, that they meant to do the same through a mechanism that was reproducing the sanctions in several layers. They call it reproduced, relabeled, reimposed, and imposed similar sanctions to the JCPOA nuclear-related sanctions. They are identical. They put it behind them so that if they eventually remove the nuclear-related sanctions, alleging that they are the only sanctions consistent with the nuclear deal, mentioned in the nuclear deal, then the economic pressures would be left intact, and Tehran would be forced to go for negotiations over its original program. And if they remove this second layer, again, there is a third layer in place to force Tehran to go for negotiations over its missile program into the end, over human rights and other things. And it's clear that this would continue for good, and Tehran would never enjoy the merits of the nuclear deal. So what they are trying to do is exactly the same. But more importantly, technically speaking, this is the pattern. This is the content, the agenda of the International Crisis Group. International Crisis Group was the main think tank that was running the talks since over a decade ago. They were present in the talks on behalf of the U.S. Secretary of State. And then they tried to set the agenda very covertly, and they tried to advance this agenda. They earned probably some goals, but they were noticed, and they never went ignored by the Iranians, and they were traced by many experts. Starting with myself in Tehran, we talked a lot about the ICJ agenda. And then in its last report on the JCPOA, how to revive the JCPOA after Biden came to office, they introduced a similar agenda that's still being pursued. But what they don't understand is that the power structure in Tehran has changed. The parliament has changed. The Supreme National Security Council structure has changed. The revolutionaries, the critics of the deal, are in power. They may not push this agenda forward, and they realized it, they experienced it. First, when the Iranian parliament approved the bill and increased their leverage on the United States, ending up in the first defeat of President Biden's administration, Biden was showing reluctance to join the talks, hoping that Tehran would give up its leverages. But after that parliament bill and law, they lost the first round of game, and they rushed to the talks in a sudden change of heart after they realized that the Iran's leverage is growing on them. So basically speaking, the ICJ agenda has been ruined. They need to realize that this agenda won't work. When they tried to offer Tehran a humiliating offer to release Iranian frozen assets in return for the giving up of Iran's two important leverages of enrichment and operation of highly advanced centrifuge machines, Tehran rejected it outright. Mm-hmm. Then they attacked Natanz. That was an Israeli and American plan in order to wear off Iran's leverage. Tehran retaliated that initially, not altogether. This is not a single response. That's the initiation of Iranian response by enhancing enrichment to 60%. Apparently, the Americans have been, you know, somehow very slow in understanding and coping with the situation. Therefore, Tehran needs to step up its leverages to give them more incentive to give up this agenda because it doesn't work. Robert Mulley, after Obama, went to ICJ and became the regional office director of the International Crisis Group, and then he ran the International Crisis Group. He was the boss of Abu Bias, and apparently he is very passionate and he's very loyal to the ICJ agenda. The Washington officials and Biden administration should realize, Jake Sullivan and especially Blinken and Biden himself should realize that agenda of the ICJ doesn't work. They need to cope with the situation, remove all and all of the sanctions that they placed after the JCPOA was endorsed by Tehran and the world powers, if they want to maintain the nuclear deal. Otherwise, they have no more than 6 weeks. The window of opportunity will close fast, and this 24th of May date will not be extended for sure.
Very well, we're going to leave it there. Thank you very much for that. Heinz Kirchner, political scientist at the International Institute for Peace from Vienna. And thank you so much, Mustafa Hoshesh, journalist and political commentator. Moving on, clashes have broken out between police and protesters in the U.S. state of Minnesota on the sixth night of unrest over the police killing of a black man. Riot police fired tear gas and flashbangs to disperse protesters from Brooklyn Center. Several protesters were arrested during the unrest. Last week, 20-year-old Dante Wright was fatally shot by a white officer, Kimberly Potter, who is not charged with second-degree manslaughter. Wright was initially pulled over by the police for an expired registration tag on his vehicle. The shooting has once again escalated tensions in Minnesota, where a similar incident last year ignited months of anti-racism rallies and clashes between protesters and the police. Protesters have hit the streets, meanwhile, of the U.S. city of Chicago to demand justice for a 13-year-old Latino boy who was fatally shot by a police officer 2 weeks ago. The march started peacefully, but it ended with clashes and arrests. Protesters called for the defunding of the Chicago Police Department. The demonstration came one day after the release of the officer's body camera video showing him shooting Adam Toledo on March 29th in Chicago. The footage shows Adam running from the officer down an alley and then putting his hands up before being shot. It did not appear as the officer claimed the boy was holding a gun, but another video shows police discovering a weapon there. This comes as tensions are running high across the country over racial injustice and police brutality against people of color. Ramin Mazari says the number of people turning out to protest Toledo's shooting death shows how much anger is out there.
I was just at that protest, and you had about 2,000 people there. And for the United States, that's a very, very big protest. And that really indicates how sort of shocking this video was. and how much anger there is. We have seen the video. It's my opinion and the opinion of other journalists that what 13-year-old Adam Toledo did is it seems like he dropped a gun and then he just tossed it over a fence, and then responding to the officer's orders, he turned around and he showed his hands. And less than 1 second later, as soon as he did that, and the video shows very clearly, the light is on him, flashlights are on him, his hands are up, he's not holding a gun, the cop still shot him. So, it's a situation where the kid did seem to have a gun, but he wasn't unarmed. And undoubtedly, this cop had a hair trigger. And as a result, he shot a 13-year-old. And what the protesters were telling me today is, why wasn't, how could this not have been resolved by a conversation? It's the kind of thing that absolutely didn't need to happen, but it just happens so very, very often here in the United States.
The U.S. president has called firearms deaths in the U.S., quote, a national embarrassment, urging Congress to take action. Biden also urged Congress to ban military-style assault weapons and large-capacity ammunition magazines. The new administration is taking limited measures to tackle gun violence amid divisions in Congress, with Republicans opposing new limits. Biden's remarks follow a spate of mass shootings across the U.S. On Thursday, 8 people were killed and several others wounded at a shooting in Indianapolis. 147 mass shootings have been reported so far this year. Official figures show that nearly 20,000 Americans died last year as a result of gun violence across the U.S. And that does it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Depleted uranium made a spectacular entrance on the battlefront in 1991. During the first Persian Gulf War, bombs and shells made with this high-density metal annihilated Saddam Hussein's tanks. And since then, the U.S. military have regarded depleted uranium munitions as the magic weapon. For those who use it, depleted uranium is beyond reproach. But others say it is a deadly poison. So who's right and who's wrong? Many countries possess weapons based on depleted uranium, and experimentation has been rife. But the consequences for civilians and the military alike have been dramatic. Today's documentary, Depleted Uranium, A Very Presentable Killer, compares and contrasts the arguments of those who defend and attack a technology that is highly toxic. Stay with us for the first part.
It's a wonderful weapon. Depleted uranium is a very dense, hard metal. And you put it on the end of a bullet, or you put it on the end of a shell, and it'll go through a tank and go through the second tank. I mean, it's wonderful from a military standpoint.
Based on the fact that certain armies around the world are developing new armor plating capabilities, which can't be pierced other than by depleted uranium munitions, it's quite normal to conserve a high-level operational capability that the French army envisages equipping its Leclerc tanks with this type of munitions.
I was trying to say, hey guys, you may be creating a problem. I have been very careful not to accuse, because you know, j'accuse is a pretty strong thing to say to somebody.
My name is Jacques Charmelot. I've been a journalist for 30 years. I've covered conflicts in Africa, Iran, Lebanon, Iraq, and in the Balkans. And I've worked in Washington, a secret and powerful city. July the 4th, 2012, I'm in America's federal capital. I'm in the crowd attending the Independence Day parade. But my thoughts are elsewhere. I'm back from a battleground that the American soldiers have just left, Iraq. Barack Obama has put an end to more than 20 years of war-torn confrontation between the US and this distant country. But what I saw there is indelibly etched on my memory. Depleted uranium begins in Iraq. Iraq has been subjected to more than 50 years of revolutions, dictatorships, and wars. And it's trying with all its might to be reborn. But its poisoned past weighs heavy on the fate of 30 million Iraqi citizens. My investigation begins in Basra, a huge port caught between Iran, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia. In February 1991, it is at the heart of the international offensive to drive Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. Iraqi tanks want to leave the small emirate, but American planes, masters of guise, are waiting for them. I head for the scene of the Iraqi rout.
I took part in the war in Kuwait against the American forces.
Could you tell us about leaving Kuwait? How it happened for you?
I fought in the war up to the very end until the Iraqi army retreated, but it wasn't so much a retreat as every man for himself. The road was exposed and the planes bombarded our military forces. That was the situation with our tanks. The road was open and straight, and it was very easy for the Americans to bomb our tanks. It was this, the road of death.
The final battle in the war lasted just 10 hours. Hundreds of tanks and vehicles were blown into shreds and abandoned in the desert. Much later, an official American document explains why the success was so devastating. On the road of death, American pilots used a newcomer to their weaponry arsenal. They fired thousands of rounds containing at least 320 tons of depleted uranium. The rounds are equipped with a depleted uranium arrowhead penetrator, which can pierce any armor plating. They catch fire on impact, reaching over 1,000 degrees, igniting the target and emitting a cloud of fine dust. They are real tank killers. Four countries are the main producers: the United States, Russia, China, and France. Natural uranium is used in numerous countries. Once enriched, it becomes highly radioactive and is used in atomic weapons and nuclear power stations. The residue of the enrichment process is called depleted uranium. It is weakly radioactive, but is not degradable. It has to be securely stored or recycled. 50,000 tons are produced around the world every year. In Basra, depleted uranium is accused of leaving a terrible legacy. I head for the city's central hospital.
Are you being treated?
Yes, I'm still being treated. Until God takes my soul. They diagnosed cancer in my pancreas and then my liver. You know, the countries that started the wars don't come to help us. They poured their poison on us and then they went away.
In 1991, the first Gulf War started, and at that time I was here on a duty at night duty, when the airplanes, fighters and bombs. After that, by many years, 3 or 4 years, we start to see many cases of cancer. If we compare it to the 80s or 90s, we found there is an increase of, say, fourfold. 1996, somebody came here with a delegation, escorting a delegation. He's from the security, and he knows about the problem, and he told me, "Doctor, you know that we are under the effects of depleted uranium, which is used by the American." Yeah, he just whispered into my ear that we got this problem. And so we start to have a link between the use of depleted uranium and the increased cancer rates. You know, now we have what we call a cancer phobia here among people. Everybody who got a mass, they think that we got a cancer.
Even before Dr. Jawad Al-Ali learned about the dangers of depleted uranium, in 1995, the Americans produced a film alerting its own soldiers to the risks involved with the heavy metal.
Battlefields and fighting are by nature hazardous to your health. Some hazards are easy to identify and well understood. Soldiers recognize the serious hazards presented by incoming artillery shells and bullets and take appropriate actions. However, some lesser hazards from new technological applications are not so well known and recognized. One of these newer applications is the use of depleted uranium in munitions and equipment armor.
The film fixes three safety rules for dealing with potential depleted uranium contamination. Get away as far as possible, as quickly as possible, and avoid any exposure to the skin. Three rules that were impossible to respect in Basra. I discover one of the tank cemeteries that abound throughout the city. There are thousands of tons of debris, some of which contaminated by depleted uranium dust, have been accessible to the population here for 20 years. I'll ask the head of the Environment Ministry why such dangerous metal wasn't removed to safety.
After 1991, we had a full report on the sites and their effects. There was no department to deal with it. Every time we found a piece of contaminated metal, we identified it with a red or yellow tag. Before 2003, we put a notice, "Danger, contaminated fragment, do not approach." Shortly after, we'd return to the same place and the notices would have disappeared and we'd find them somewhere else. Even if we deemed it important at the time, it was only relatively important, as the situation was very complex and local authorities had other concerns. Why did the Americans from 2003 and even since 1991 not remove or displace the metal waste? They did nothing at the time. The likely reason, in my view, is that they hadn't yet measured the effects of using this weaponry. They wanted to see the results and the effects after 5, 10, and 15 years, etc. God will decide. But the munitions they used against us will have effects on our children, our grandchildren, and our great-grandchildren for generations to come, probably until the end of time.
During the invasion of Kuwait, Paris was a faithful ally of the USA, and French troops played a crucial role. I contact journalist Marie-Claude Dubin, who was at the front line.
There was a tank which looked all burnt up. And I said, can I go inside? It's not mine. No, it's not mine. You can go in. I raised up clouds of dust, and I never imagined that the ashes were mixed with depleted uranium dust.
What illness are you suffering from?
An autoimmune disease. I've been told it attacks the nerves, muscles, the thyroid, plus certain neurocognitive problems, neuromuscular lesions.
To get a clearer picture of what happened to Marie-Claude Dubin and to patients in the Basra Hospital, I go to Valence to see a scientist. For years, Roland Debord has been speaking out against the risks of depleted uranium. He's the president of CRIRAD.
We know that depleted uranium is pyrophoric, which means that it ignites spontaneously in the air, with the oxygen in the air. A flameless combustion, but with oxidization, producing uranium oxide, which is an extremely fine dust that's released into the air. You can then be contaminated internally, either through inhalation, if you're not wearing a mask, or by ingestion, because it'll be on your fingers. The uranium combines many risks, but why? Because it's an alpha emitter, and alpha radiation is what causes the most internal damage. Secondly, because it's a heavy metal, and we retain it. It metabolizes within the organism for many long years. For it to lose half its radioactivity, it takes 4.5 billion years.
4.5 billion years is the same age as planet Earth. These concerns over the harmful effects of depleted uranium dust are shared by official scientific bodies.
The problem is, in the case of internal contamination, either you ingest it because you're in a contaminated environment and it can be found in the water and in food, or you inhale and the particles of depleted uranium reach your lungs. There are two phases to this. Firstly, the uranium particles have to be dissolved to get into the blood, and once they're in the bloodstream, they'll be distributed among the various organs. Once in the organs, either it builds up or it doesn't.
We often refer to the case of the Iraqi children who play in the tanks that were destroyed and who collect the scrap metal and cut it up, or housewives who sometimes recycle the metal to make pots that they'll subsequently cook in. Do you think there's a risk?
There are potential effects, especially if there's repeated exposure, even if it's not chronic. And this will be the case. Children come to play, water is cooked in the pots. With ingestion, with repeated administration within the body, even if you only have weak doses, the fact of accumulating the various doses can ultimately have an effect on health.
Clearly, the depleted uranium dust falls down, and it settles.
Yes. Once it falls, obviously the ground will be contaminated. Afterwards, it depends on how this contamination comes about, if it's very localized or not, and whether it's in towns or in fields which will be cultivated. So there will definitely be a contamination of the environment.
Things are becoming clearer to me, and more worrying. The depleted uranium particles are dangerous for health and for nature. The career of depleted uranium munitions began in Iraq, but it continued in the heart of Europe, just a few hours by air from capital cities like Paris, Rome, and Berlin. I walk among the graves in the Jewish cemetery in Sarajevo. It was from here that Serbian snipers kept the besieged city locked down. The journalists, who, like myself, came to cover the conflict, often found themselves behind the yellow walls of the Holiday Inn. In 1992, divisions in Yugoslavia forced Bosnia into a war. In April, the inhabitants of Sarajevo were trapped. The UN launched an impossible mission to reconcile Muslims, Serbs, and Croats. But the war dragged on, and in 1995, NATO intervened. NATO planes, mostly American, bombed the Serbs, who were forced to make peace. The Sniper Alley tramway takes me to Hadići, a suburb on the outskirts of Sarajevo. I enter a ruined factory, a key element in the Serbs' military industry. Tanks and cannons were repaired here. NATO planes attacked the Hadići factory 7 times in September 1995 and fired more than 4,000 depleted uranium shells. When peace was reinstated, many Serbs from Hadići moved to Bratunac, a Serbian republic town in eastern Bosnia. They went there to live, and also to die. Nedeljko Zelenović is a journalist and a witness. He has investigated the NATO bombings. His father, uncle, cousins, and dozens of friends worked in the Hadići factory.
All the workers who worked on the assembly lines at the time, who were caught in the fighting, and later, at the time I was following events, they all died from various forms of cancer. In 1996, the population of Bratunac was between 20 and 22,000 people. And less than 5% of them came from Hadići. That year, in 1996, 154 people were buried in the Bratunac Municipal Cemetery. 3% of them came from Hadići. But in 2000, 105 people were buried in Bratunac, and 50% of them came from Hadići. I have a few names if you're interested.
Jerić Budimir, Andrić Drago, Mastilo Dušan, Banduka Milinko, Banduka Danilo, Aleksić Nenad, Makajić Simo, Stanojević Relja, Puša Ramon, Runtaš Ljubica, Lavušić Mostar.
What did your son die of?
He was diagnosed with leukemia. I asked what it was caused by, and they told me it was due to depleted uranium.
Mehmed Telalevich is a Muslim. During the war, he fled Hadići, driven out by the Serbs. In 1996, he returned home, close to the ruins of the arms factory. He found his house, blown apart by bombs. Mehmed rebuilt it, not suspecting that the land around it had been contaminated by poisonous dust.
We were never told. Nobody ever said anything. The public at large can't even be aware of it, as this disease is really a lottery. You put up with it, you fight it, and you might live or die. I know at least 10 people here, all young, aged between 35 and 40. They all have a cancer.
Mehmet tells me that he discovered he had colon cancer in 2004. He's taken chemotherapy and is now in remission. But the news is not good. The latest tests revealed that his prostate is 4 times bigger than normal. He has blood in his urine.
I've become fragile. Before I could take normal showers, but now I have to have very, very hot showers. I have to wear leggings. I'm cold all the time. I'm delicate. My blood is anemic. I've no immunity.
Are you sure all this is because of the factory?
Oh yes, I'm 100% certain. There are no other diseases here apart from cancer.
I pursue the depleted uranium trail in Italy. A great ally of the USA within NATO, the country organized humanitarian missions in Bosnia. It later sent a strong contingent to separate Serbs and Albanians in Kosovo. And it was in Italy that the dangers of depleted uranium weapons were widely exposed in late 1999. In Rome, I meet another Italian soldier who'd been sent to the Balkans, Colonel Americo Lacetti.
So it began in 1999. I came back in 1999, and on December 24th, I had an X-ray. I remember I was alone with the technician. There was nobody at the hospital. When I asked him what I had, he said, "What have you got?" And then he said, "Enjoy Christmas, because you won't be here next year." I had this lump, 24 centimeters long, 14 centimeters wide, and 12 centimeters thick. A tumor in my lungs. After that, I had other tests, and they took a piece of the tumor and examined it. Inside were numerous ceramic particles, perfectly round. And they contained a load of substances that don't exist naturally. But they do exist when a depleted uranium projectile strikes a hard surface. This produces a cloud of dust, which when you inhale it, creates this type of pathology. I'm now living in a body that's mine.
As the death toll builds in Italy, the public is outraged, and the government has to act. On January the 3rd, 2001, the Prime Minister, Giuliano Amato, breaks the official silence and announces that he is going to demand a full account from NATO. But this demand will have little effect.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, it's an honor and a joy to have you with us again on today's episode of The Lantern, only from IORIB English Radio. Thank you so very much for being with us. Today I want to talk about something that's really a pretty sensitive topic, in the sense that it's sensitive because it's a little hard to detect. It's a little hard to pick out and to determine, but at the same time, it's very detrimental to a person's faith and their salvation in the hereafter. As human beings, as creatures of this material world, we have the love for certain material concepts instilled within us because it is the prerequisite of having a dominant aspect of our creation being material. What I'm trying to say is that even though we are multifaceted and we have a soul, we have a body, we have a mind, some people might argue that the soul and the mind aren't separate. Some people might argue that the mind and the body are not separate. Anyway, in any sense, we are very multi-dimensional creatures. And as strong as our spiritual aspect could be, and as some people might argue that our soul is what defines us, and I'm not disagreeing with that in any way, not today at least, we can't deny, however, that this world was the first dimension that we can consciously relate to. This world, this material world, is the first dimension that we consciously relate to and we consciously feel and we have total and full awareness of, right? And because of that, certain biological attachments, love, and desire toward this material world exists within us. We can't deny that either. However, it is religion's job, and it is the teachings of the spiritual domain's job to help us regulate this love and attachment we have toward the material world, because if we don't, then it will be our doom. Okay? Let's listen to a very short, very interesting anecdote to get a better grasp of what I'm trying to say. Well, actually, no. Before we do that, one of the greatest loves we have toward this material world is the love of position, is the love of power. Let's listen to a short anecdote, a short, interesting anecdote to get a better idea of what I'm trying to say, and we're going to be right back.
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salaamu Alaikum and welcome to this program entitled Lantern. As usual, we have a nice story. Position has its value. Once upon a time, a goat was grazing near her master's cottage. All of a sudden, she saw green grass growing on the roof of the cottage. Deciding to enjoy it, she leaped onto the roof and started browsing the green shoots of the grass. Just then a wolf came there and seeing the goat, his mouth started watering, but he was unable to get to the roof of the cottage, so he turned to go away to look for some other prey. The goat saw the wolf licking his chops, so she laughed in her sleeves and looked at him with jeering eyes. The wolf, being helpless, had to tolerate this mockery. While walking away, the wolf looked up and said, "Young lady, it's not you who is mocking at me, but it is the height at which you are standing. Your high position has given you your value."
Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
There's a very interesting hadith from the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam that says, that basically explains the last thing that will exit the heart of a true believer is the love for power. What does this mean? Okay, as human beings, we have love toward our family, our possessions, our friends, our wealth, but most of all, we have a love toward position. The love toward position is more important than the love toward possession. When we have enough power, when we have a platform, when we have a status that people take notice of, a status that gives us a voice, a status that allows us to influence other people, it doesn't matter if we're not rich, it doesn't matter if we're not pretty, it doesn't matter if we don't have a family to back us up. If we have that status, if we have that power to control the people's minds and hearts, we have it all. we have it all. Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wa sallam was an orphan boy, spent most of his youth as a shepherd, taking sheep and goats and herds of the people of Mecca to the outskirts of the city for grazing. Sure, one would say that he was from the tribe of Quraysh and from the most prominent family of Quraysh, was with Bani Hashim. He had a great reputation, he had his family to back him up, but still he was a little orphan boy. He was known as the orphan of Bani Hashim. He never met his father. His mother died at a young age. He wasn't filthy rich in any way. As a matter of fact, him marrying Sayyidah Khadija, who was the billionaire of her time, incapabled him of doing a lot of things that he otherwise would not have been able to do for Islam. But he had such control over the hearts and minds of people that he, 1400 years later, is one of the most famous, most well-known characters of history. Even if you take away that religious, spiritual aspect. Why? Because of that status. Sure, you might also say that that status would have not been achieved was it not for Lady Khadija's money. Again, toward the end of Lady Khadija's life, none of that money was there anymore. They were sanctioned. They were in the valley of Abu Talib, and the entirety of the Muslim Ummah lived on a few pieces of date fruits. Rasulullah wasn't a wealthy human being, but he had that position. And as was Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam and Fatima al-Zahra, the position of being the daughter of Rasulullah. For most of her life, everyone respected her. Everyone looked up to her. I'm not saying that this is a bad thing. I'm saying it's a very important thing. And at the end of the day, that is the final state, the final level of love toward this world, these material things that any believer has to take out of his heart. The hadith says that it has to be taken out of a person's heart because, well, it doesn't last, does it? Of course, the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam and Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, they had the position that they had because Allah is the one who gives izzah, who gives dignity and honor to the believers, as the Quran states. Of course, their position and the love that the human beings had toward them was because they were pious, because they were lovable human beings, they were infallible, they were generous, they were kind, they were compassionate, they were giving, they were forgiving, they were merciful, they were intelligent, they were knowledgeable, they were wise, and the list goes on and goes on and goes on. But the point of the matter is that it is through position, it is through status that things get done by a human being. Today, why is it that so many people are striving to become influencers? Because being able to have that position status to influence other people is power. And power is everything. Power over people's minds and heart means being able to control them, being able to determine their fate, being able to determine and direct them toward the course of life. Who doesn't want that? However, if that power is used in corrupt ways, if that power is used for corrupted means, that person will not gain anything in this world nor the hereafter. That's all the time we have for today's episode of The Lantern. Thank you so very much for being with us. I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.